Hello, it is Monday, the 22nd of June. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. Talks between the United States and Iran inch forward as ships continue to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, including two South Korean vessels. More on that shortly. In our in-depth news analysis, we talk more about the potential reprieve, or a lack thereof, that the U.S.-Iran talks could produce. In other news, Starbucks Korea closed its stores early nationwide to provide history classes to its employees. Plus, in our weekly sports roundup, we discuss the coming World Cup match between South Korea and South Africa. All that and more on Korea 24. A tense first round of talks between the United States and Iran ended in the early hours of Monday in Switzerland. Mediators Qatar and Pakistan said the two sides agreed to establish a communication line on the Strait of Hormuz and a so-called Lebanon deconfliction mechanism. As negotiations continued to play out amid the ceasefire, dozens of ships were reportedly transiting the strait, including two South Korean-operated vessels. For more on the talks and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-young. Hello, In-young.
Hello, Andrew.
The first round of talks to reach a final peace agreement is over. It was reported over the weekend that Iranian officials initially stormed out of the talks. In-young, can you explain what happened?
Sure. Before the start of negotiations at Lake Lucerne in Switzerland on Sunday, Vice President J.D. Vance, who left the U.S. side, expressed confidence that the United States and Iran could turn over a new leaf at the meeting. But Iranian officials walked out of the talks after just 80 minutes in protest of President Trump's public threats to obliterate the regime if Iran closes the Strait of Hormuz. Behind the scenes, though, mediators Qatar and Pakistan helped talks continue until the session wrapped up some 18 hours later.
And what did the U.S. and Iran agree to after that mediation?
In a joint statement, the mediators said the two sides agreed to create a deconfliction cell to ensure adherence to the termination of military operations in Lebanon, where Israel's military has been fighting the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah. The parties also decided to open a communications line to help ensure safe passage for commercial ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran was quite happy with the agreement. The spokesperson for Iran's delegation in Switzerland said there has been, quote, good progress in negotiations on a final peace agreement. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi wrote on X that his country received waivers for oil and petrochemical exports, the U.S. naval blockade was lifted, and some frozen Iranian assets were released.
As the talks continue, two more South Korean vessels have passed through the Strait of Hormuz. It was the first time that South Korean ships have transited the waterway since the U.S. and Iran signed an interim peace deal last week. In-young, what can you tell us?
Seoul's Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries said Monday that the vessels, which have no South Korean crew members on board, are sailing normally but have not yet fully exited a high-risk zone. There are still 22 South Korean ships stranded in the strait waiting for permission from Iran to pass. Under the MOU with the U.S., Iran has agreed to facilitate safe passage through the strait for commercial vessels at no charge for 60 days and has since begun accepting applications from ship operators.
Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Cho Hyun said the government has been preparing for South Korean companies to participate in Middle East reconstruction projects following the ceasefire agreement between the U.S. and Iran. In-young, what can you tell us?
Cho said in a press briefing on Monday that the government has been preparing in advance for the post-conflict period. He said the government has established a South Korea and Middle East Comprehensive Economic Cooperation Team at the Foreign Ministry and worked with overseas missions to identify tailored cooperation opportunities across the region. A senior foreign ministry official clarified that the team wasn't created with participation in an Iran reconstruction fund in mind. The U.S. MOU with Iran states that the U.S. will work with regional partners to develop a $300 billion fund for Iran's reconstruction and economic development. According to foreign media reports, more than half of the proposed private sector fund has already been committed, with companies from South Korea, Japan, the U.S. and other countries said to be among those that have pledged participation.
Let's now move on to the ballot shortage protest at Olympic Park in southern Seoul, which has entered its 18th day. This is a story that's been on headlines for the last several weeks now. In a regular press briefing on Monday, the Korean National Police Agency's acting chief, Yoo Jae-sung, reaffirmed a strict stance against breaches of the law during the protest. What did he have to say?
You said expressions of concern over voting rights will be respected and protected to the fullest extent possible. But he said serious crimes such as aggravated assault will be met with prompt and decisive action, including arrests. Police are currently investigating 36 cases linked to the protests, including allegations that demonstrators searched the belongings of members of the women's national junior handball team, obstructed access to facilities operated by the Korean Sports and Olympic Committee, and assaulted a journalist. Among nine individuals accused of obstructing access to the facilities, two have been identified and summoned for questioning.
In other headlines, the Seoul Central District Court handed down its verdict on Monday for former Justice Minister Park Sung-jae, who had been indicted for playing a key role in former President Yoon Suk-yeol's martial law bid in late 2024. What was the ruling?
Park was sentenced to 25 years in prison. It was 5 years more than what the special counsel had requested. The court ordered his immediate detention due to concerns that he might destroy evidence. The court said Park convened a meeting with senior justice ministry officials in the early hours of martial law, reviewed the deployment of prosecutors to the joint investigation headquarters to be created under martial law, and checked on the capacity of prisons. The court concluded that Park took those actions in support of Yoon as part of an insurrection and also found him guilty of abusing his power by ordering preparations related to prison capacity and travel bans. The court also found him guilty of abuse of power for ordering the Justice Ministry's prosecution division to draft a document justifying the martial law order shortly after it was lifted. But the court dismissed the charge that he violated the anti-graft law, ruling that it fell outside the scope of the special counsel's mandate. Park was accused of receiving a telegram message from former First Lady Kim Gon-hee. She asked him about the progress of an investigation involving her accepting a luxury handbag, and Park allegedly looked into the case through a ministry employee.
In political news, President Lee Jae-myung's job approval rating has slipped below 50% for the first time since he took office as his administration grapples with eroded public trust following the ballot shortages in last month's local elections. In-kyung, can you walk us through the figures?
Sure. A real meter poll of 2,517 people of voting age taken Monday to Friday last week showed Lee's approval rating at 46.7%. It was down 4.8 percentage points from the previous week. The president's disapproval rating rose 5.5 percentage points to 49.7%. It was within the margin of error, but disapproval exceeded approval for the first time by 3 percentage points. Real Meter said election process mismanagement and conflict within the ruling party served as negative factors, overshadowing positives such as achievements from Lee's European trip and the KOSPI breaking 9,000 points. Lee saw his approval ratings edge down in most regions, including his strongholds of Gwangju and the Jeolla provinces. But the biggest decline was in Daegu and North Gyeongsang province, where support fell 9.9 percentage points to 34.6%. Support also slipped across most age groups. The decline was steepest among voters in their 50s, falling 9.9 percentage points to 55.5%, followed by those in their 20s, down 6.2 percentage points to 30.6%. The survey commissioned by the Economy Business newspaper has a 95% confidence level and a margin of error of plus or minus 2 percentage points.
And did the presidential office make any comments on the survey's results?
Yes, it did. The presidential office said it takes the results seriously and with humility. It said it'll look more closely into what the public is concerned about and what they want. It said the results appear to be a comprehensive reflection of the public's perception of the economy and the evaluation of overall state affairs.
And finally, Starbucks Korea closed all its stores nationwide at 3 p.m. Monday and conducted training sessions for employees to improve historical awareness and social sensitivity. In-kyung, can you tell us the details?
Yes, it was the first time since the company entered the South Korean market in 1999 that all its stores shut down simultaneously. The coffee chain had posted notices at its store since last Tuesday about the educational program and shortened operating hours. The educational program was a follow-up measure to last month's controversy over a marketing campaign that evoked painful memories of a brutal military crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in 1980. Employees watched recorded lectures on historical awareness and corporate ethics. Last week, employees at Starbucks Korea's headquarters and executives of E-Mart affiliates attended the live lectures. Starbucks Korea is operated by E-Mart, an affiliate of Shinsegae Group, and Shinsegae Group chairman Jung Yong-jin is expected to watch the same recorded training session on Wednesday ahead of an executives' meeting.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, In-kyung.
Thank you, Andrew.
Hello, my name is Anna Yates Liu, assistant professor from the Department of Korean Music at Seoul National University. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The first round of negotiations in Switzerland between the United States and Iran ended Monday amid tensions fueled by fresh threats from U.S. President Donald Trump to resume attacks on Iran, which said it closed the Strait of Hormuz again over the weekend. According to a joint statement by Qatar and Pakistan, which are serving as mediators, the U.S. and Iran agreed to try to reach a final deal within 60 days. Technical talks will continue for the rest of the week. This comes after Washington and Tehran signed a 14-point agreement, described as a memorandum of understanding, last week. It includes a commitment from both sides to engage in further talks aimed at reaching a final agreement over the next 60 days, and also refers to reopening the Strait of Hormuz and the U.S. lifting sanctions on Iran. To discuss these developments, we are joined on the line by two guests. First, we have economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Hello, Professor Yang.
Hello.
We also have Muyu Zhu, senior crude analyst at Kepler, a company that provides real-time tracking data and analytics on energy, power, and global shipping. Hello, Ms. Zhu.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. After the U.S. and Iran signed an interim peace deal last week, Iran said on Saturday that it would close the strait in response to Israeli strikes in Lebanon, which Tehran views as a violation of the truce deal. U.S. officials have disputed that account. But meanwhile, two South Korean vessels have passed through the Strait of Hormuz since the deal was signed. Seoul's Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries said Monday that the two ships have exited the choke point and are now navigating normally. Ms. Zhu, we go to you. So what do we know so far about the state of the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, we did observe a decline in vessels traffic through the Strait of Hormuz on Sunday and so far on Monday, compared with a moderate uptick following the signing of the MOU on Thursday through Saturday. That's where you see the Korean vessels pass by. And having said that, flows have not completely stopped, and even though Iran has claimed the close of the waterway. But since mid-April, we have seen an increasing number of vessels passing through the strait in the dark by switching off their signals and sailing close to the Omani coast to move oil out of the Persian Gulf. And taking crude oil as an example, 1.5 million barrels of Persian Gulf crude have been moved out using this method so far in June, and that compared with 740 KBD in May and virtually zero before the conflict. Therefore, we may see Hormuz traffic under Iranian supervision fluctuate alongside the shifting rhetoric from Tehran, while flows through less visible channels continue. However, as long as Iran retains control over Hormuz, overall traffic is expected to remain well below the pre-war levels.
So some hopeful signs in the Strait, despite Iranian threats, but far from reaching pre-war levels. Trump said the United States could impose transit fees in the Strait of Hormuz, which would probably pose another hurdle to the economic complications being caused by this war. The threat was made on the condition that if a final peace agreement with Iran is not reached. In a post on Truth Social on Saturday, Trump said no tolls would be charged during the 60-day ceasefire period outlined in the current agreement. But Iran is indicating that after 60 days, it may charge service fees for ships passing through the strait. Then, over the weekend, Trump said the United States could impose transit fees of their own in the Strait of Hormuz if a final peace agreement with Iran is not reached. He added that no tolls would be charged during the 60-day ceasefire period outlined in the current agreement, nor immediately after it expires. But what would fees, whether they had to be paid to the United States or Iran, mean for global logistics and supply chains?
I would imagine it would be difficult for either side to impose transit fees on vessels passing through the strait, whether it's under the name of insurance or environmental protection or other name, because they would face a strong pushback from both oil producers and buyers, including Iran's key partners such as China and India. After all, Asian countries still rely heavily on Persian Gulf suppliers for oil and gas, and any transit fees would increase their import cost. And for the oil producers, they may also need to lower their selling prices to make room for such fees in order to remain competitive against suppliers from other regions. And in addition, imposing transit fees would involve complex legal and sanctions-related issues, especially your fees paying to the Iranian side. And then because ship owners and cargo owners would likely refrain from making payments to Iran due to the sanction concerns. But nevertheless, the latest developments in the Middle East are set to permanently reshape the regional oil export landscape and also supply chain, because the GCC countries have become increasingly aware of the vulnerability of the Hormuz transit routes and are expected to accelerate efforts to develop alternative export channels that bypass the strait.
That's a very good point. Any attempt to impose extra fees would probably run into opposition from sellers and buyers, especially the countries that you mentioned, China and India, who have been more sympathetic to Iran. Professor Young, South Korea imports virtually all of its crude oil, with roughly 70% originating from the Middle East, and much of it transported through the Strait of Hormuz. How worried should Seoul be about these possible fees being threatened by both sides? And what would they mean for the South Korean economy?
Okay, well, it's hard to do an analysis because we don't know what the amount will be, and we don't know whether Iran will charge fees by itself or whether the United States will also impose fees. But assuming that both sides impose fees, Iran had floated the idea that they would charge about $1 million per tanker. And given an oil tanker is typically the size of an oil tanker, carries about 1 to 2 million barrels, that comes to about $1 per barrel. And then one barrel of oil is typically refined into 71 to 75 liters of gasoline. So roughly, I would say it would raise gasoline costs by about 31 per liter, 2 cents per liter U.S. So I don't think it's going to be too much of a burden. But where it might be bigger burden, where it might cause a bigger problem, is that it might cause other countries or even rebels and pirates to get the same idea, that to pass through a choke point, not necessarily Strait of Hormuz, but elsewhere, they would charge transit fees or entrance fees or safety fees or insurance fees or whatever. So in some sense, while the fees for this particular case might not be all that much, you don't want to set a precedent.
So assuming both sides impose fees, that was a nice mathematical analysis there by Professor Yang. The extra cost to the South Korean gas buyer would be, I guess, unpreferable, but would be digestible. Ms. Zhu, how do you think the situation will pan out with regard to the fees? Again, these are hypotheticals for either the U.S. or Iran.
As mentioned, imposing the fees on the traffic through such a vital waterway is highly complex, and I would expect Iran and the U.S. to continue allowing vessels to pass through free of charge, potentially framing it as a waiver, as what we are seeing now. And personally, I don't think Iran's ultimate goal is to generate revenue from the Hormuz traffic. Rather, it is a way to demonstrate its control over the Hormuz and a means of pressuring the U.S. to provide a financial compensation to the country.
So it's a way for Iran to demonstrate that it can do what it wants to do in that part of the world. Professor Yang, what do you think about the same question? How do you think the situation will develop or unfold for the United States and Iran?
Okay, well, I do agree with Ms. Zhu. I think the highest probability is that neither country charges a transit fee or insurance fee or whatever. But I think if one side does not give up and one side said that it will charge a fee, I think the other side will automatically follow and say that they will charge a fee. So I think the second highest probability event, even though it's probably going to be a lot further down than not charging any fees at all. But the second most likely event is that both U.S. and Iran will charge fees. I do not really see a case where just one side charges a fee. I don't think the other side will stand still and let the other side take an advantage.
That would be an interesting contingency where both sides are charging money to everyone, which is a scenario that I don't think anyone really wants. The first round of tense talks between the United States and Iran ended in the early hours of Monday. Mediators Qatar and Pakistan said the two sides agreed to establish a communication line on the Strait of Hormuz and a so-called Lebanon deconflication mechanism. Of course, Lebanon is one facet of these negotiations. Assuming that the United States and Iran reach a final deal within 60 days, again, that's a hypothetical. How long, Ms. Zhu, do you think oil flows and prices will need to return to pre-war levels? Are we talking about weeks, months, or years?
I think the pace of recovery will largely depend on whether Iran honors its commitments. And at this moment, we see around 290 laden vessels across all asset classes remain stranded in the Persian Gulf, with liquid tankers accounting for about half of that volumes. And if Iran guarantees safe and free passage, we expect clearing this backlog alone would take about 2-3 weeks. However, the backlog clearance is just a one-off event. The real story is how quickly vessels re-enter the Persian Gulf. And currently, there are more than 100 ballast vessels positioned within a seven-day sailing range of the Hormuz. But we expect only a slow and gradual return, likely reaching just 50% of the pre-war level within a month or so. And if there are setbacks from Iranian side and ship owners deem the situation unsafe, the recovery would be much, much slower. And even in the most optimistic scenario where Hormuz traffic gradually picks up, we still expect it would take about 2 months for the Middle Eastern oil producers to recover their production to around 80% of their pre-war level. But having said that, oil prices have seen a sharp decline in recent days because investors have become increasingly optimistic about the situation. While some might argue argue that the price may be overcorrected, we do see a risk of short-term oversupply because at least 80 million barrels of stranded crude oil would come out of the Persian Gulf in a short period. But the demand may not recover quickly enough to absorb the additional supply. But even so, oil prices should continue to find support from the geopolitical risk in the Middle East and from countries seeking to rebuild their SPRs, their strategic oil reserve, over the medium term. So this suggests that oil prices are unlikely to return to the pre-war level on a sustained basis until perhaps late 2027.
So even in the best or optimistic scenarios, we would need a few weeks to clear the backlog that's already clogging the Strait of Hormuz, and another month or two for vessels to re-enter the strait. And there's also the interesting prospect of an oil oversupply, which would be, again, somewhat unexpected from the ordinary consumer's point of view. Professor Yang, what about the South Korean economy, though? This is a natural question that we all have. How long would it take for the South Korean economy to stabilize and return to pre-war levels?
Okay, well, Ms. Zhu has mentioned some of these factors. Let me just repeat them somewhat. It will take weeks for these trapped Korean transport to return to Korea. And each of these tankers basically just supply maybe 1 or 2 days worth of oil consumption, because Korea's daily oil consumption is about 2.8 million barrels. Now, we've been able to get supply from elsewhere, so there might be some aspects of oversupply, but that would, as Ms. Yu mentioned, only be temporary. Some of the longer-term factors, it'll take about 1 to 2 months for production to restart again. And then there were some production facilities which were destroyed during the war. I think it takes about 6 months to 2 years to get those facilities reconstructed. And I think that in the longer term, there will be heightened demand because private companies and governments have run down their reserves, so they want to build it back up again. And there's, I think, an additional factor for Korea. We have the wholesale price ceiling. So for Korean consumers, because Korean consumers had cheaper than global price for their gasoline and diesel fuel, until the worldwide price goes below that ceiling price, you won't see any effect on consumer pumps. So it'll take, I think, longer for Korean prices to fall than in other countries, but that's because we're paying cheaper price to begin with. Now, in the long term, will we get back to pre-war prices? Ms. Zhu and I may disagree on this, but the pre-war price of gasoline was $55 to $60 per barrel. That was, if you look at the 21st century as a group, last 20 years, that is a very low price. So I'm not sure if we will get back to that very low price, at least for the next couple of years, if ever. Yes, the price will fall. It'll take maybe at the start or middle of fourth quarter to see the prices actually falling in the pumps. But will we get back to pre-war price? Well, maybe next year, but maybe not, because the price of pre-war oil was really cheap to begin with.
Mm. So a little more pessimistic there. Prices not expected to return to pre-war levels until maybe next year, if at all, from Professor Yang there. But Ms. Zhu, current global geopolitical risks have spurred government and corporate efforts here in South Korea to broaden their supply networks and to actively diversify their crude oil sellers to reduce heavy reliance on the Middle East. Do you think the supply dynamics of oil will change going forward, and for South Korea and other East Asian or Southeast Asian countries?
I would expect the Asian countries, including South Korea, to continue pushing for greater diversification of their oil supplies and to expand their onshore oil storage capacity in order to improve their energy security and resilience in the event of a similar crisis in the future. However, Middle Eastern countries will continue to play a vital role in Asian oil imports because of their large supply volumes and relatively short voyage times. And that means a full replacement of or a sharp shift away from the Middle Eastern oil is unlikely, especially as most refineries in Asia are designed to process the Middle Eastern grades. And that said, I still think the countries would look to expand the long-term cooperation with oil producers in the west of Suez, for instance, the United States, where the Latin American countries like Brazil, Guyana, and some West African countries, but that shift may not become that rapid or in a big scale in the short term.
So I guess diversification is somewhat expected, but as Ms. Zhu nicely points out, fully replacing the supplies from the Middle East is would be very difficult to do, at least in the short term. Professor Young, we pose the same question to you. Do you think that diversification will go on, and do you think the oil supply networks to Asian countries will change?
I'm a bit pessimistic about that. I'm not sure if the diversification will continue after even if the war is over. As the oil price goes down, I'm not sure if the diversification that we have. We apparently imported a lot of oil from Indonesia and Canada, which we don't typically do. I'm not sure if that kind of trend will continue, basically because Korea, maybe other countries as well, but Korea in particular, gravitates toward the cheapest and politically easiest option, and that is fossil fuels, natural gas, and oil. There's a popular resistance to renewable energy like solar, wind, and hydropower here. And there's also resistance to nuclear power. And most power plants that were built in the last decade or 15 years were mostly natural gas, but also oil and some coal. So we've actually, in some sense, increased our dependence on fossil fuels. But Korea's demand for cheap energy is really high because not only Korean consumers consume relatively high levels of energy compared to, say, the OECD average. Korea specializes in manufacturing, especially energy-intensive manufacturing, semiconductors, automobiles, shipbuilding, petrochemicals, and steel. And all of these depend on basic, cheaper energy supply. So I think once the oil prices go down, I think we'll gravitate toward cheaper energy, oil energy again, and that's going to leave us vulnerable unless we make a conscious decision to diversify not only the sources of oil, but sources of energy.
So the addiction to fossil fuels will be tough to kill, according to Professor Yang. But that's all for today's in-depth news analysis. That was Professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Thank you, Professor Yang.
Thank you.
And we also had Muyu Zhu from Kepler, a company that provides real-time data on energy, power, and global shipping. Thank you, Ms. Zhu.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 62.13 points, or 0.69%, on Monday to close at 9,114.55. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 1.81 points, or 0.19%, to close at 968.4. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story today?
Overcrowding issues in prison in Korea has become something that's been a very growing concern here. A recent report focused on a women's prison in Cheongju, which supposedly had relatively better conditions than other such institutions, but it's getting worse there too.
So how bad is this overcrowding situation like in this facility?
According to a local media outlet that took a closer look into the living conditions inside Cheongju Women's Prison in Cheongju City, North Chungcheong Province, the capacity there is 619. Currently, there are 742 inmates. A typical cell, slightly larger than 16 square meters, houses nearly double the originally designated number of inmates at 9. In some cases, 12 share this very tight space. When all cellmates are lying down, the person next to you have to get up and step aside if you want to turn around or move. That's how tight it gets.
So I guess the concern is more about what these agitated and more volatile prisoners might do to the innocent prison guards on duty there.
Yes, the prison officers are constantly on edge and alert, especially since they are not allowed to wield weapons and only wear protective gear, apparently, according to regulations. They must pay attention to even when they're delivering food or rationing food, as even small differences could lead to violent protests. At night, there are only about 18 prison guards to manage the entire population of over 740, so that's one prison guard to about 41 inmates. As summer arrives, things get worse with a lack of cooling facilities, just 2 wall fans per cell, and they're not even turned on all the time. 50-minute operation, 10-minute pause.
The figures are indeed concerning. Are we expecting to see any major responses from the government soon?
A One Justice Ministry survey in 2024 showed that prison officials were nearly 3 times more likely to consider planning to take one's own life due to stress compared to adults in other professions, clearly showing the need to make changes to resolve prison overpopulation, which leads to violent behavior by inmates and heightened stress level for prison officers. To address the overcrowding situation, the ministry said it plans to devise new policies to help improve correctional facility conditions as well as rehab programs.
Some serious findings there. I'm hoping the next story will be a little lighter.
It actually is. There's a growing number of South Koreans who are getting into a new type of shopping and food delivery platforms. They simulate the experience of shopping or ordering food without actually involving spending money or having the product delivered.
This is a very odd subject, but can you better acquaint us with this, quote, fake consumption trend?
Sure thing. One delivery simulation site that's been gaining popularity on social media allows users to browse menus, customize orders, place virtual payments, and even track a delivery rider in real time. And users receive a delivery notification, but no food arrives. Virtual shopping offers all the rituals of consumption, browsing menus, filing or filling carts, tracking deliveries and completing purchases, but they all do not involve spending a single one.
So why are these types of services growing in popularity?
Well, users satisfy impulses to order food, shop online, or book tickets, but they can do that while avoiding the financial and emotional costs, sometimes which comes with the consequences or regrets from those purchases. One creator of such site claimed to have been struggling with delivery addiction, so the creator devised this delivery addiction treatment simulation app. The creator explained that in the case of food deliveries, after a detailed and realistic virtual order is completed, the app even displays how many calories the user has avoided gaining by not eating the meal. The post attracted more than 5 million views.
So I'm suspecting there's something more to this beyond simulated food ordering and shopping.
Virtual shopping platforms allow users to purchase fictional products ranging from time machines and wish-granting tickets all the way to cloned dolls that supposedly go to work on behalf of its owner. The reviews written by some of the users grab attention too, some marveling at how effective they are, while others complain about malfunctions or side effects.
It all sounds fun and harmless, but I also suspect some people might have some reservations. What did the experts have something to say about this?
Well, some experts say that being able to enjoy the pleasurable part of consumption without the consequences can be healthy and fun, but the effect may differ from person to person. They're best used as tool for managing impulsive behavior rather than replacing real-world decision-making.
Shall we turn to our final story?
Yes, let's do that. South Korea's state insurance program will review covering prescriptions for hair loss treatment. A welcome news for some, but there are people expressing concerns and even opposition to it.
So what kind of coverage, though, and what specific type of condition is the government potentially covering?
The government is weighing whether to extend national health insurance coverage to androgenetic alopecia, the common hereditary form of hair loss often associated locally with the letter M-shaped hairlines, for those between ages 20 and 34. The health ministry plans to hold a public forum in July with around 200 members of the public invited to participate.
So I suspect there are some reasons and some room for opposition to this potential policy. But what is the main reason that the government is actually pursuing this coverage expansion?
Well, several years ago, back in 2022, it was initially viewed as a populist campaign promise from President Lee Jae-myung when he was running for top office post back then, claiming hair loss causes not only financial but psychological stress for young people. He, now president, pushed the issue forward, mentioning a health ministry briefing late last year that hair loss was no longer merely a cosmetic concern but a matter of survival affecting quality of life and social opportunity even. A Gallup Korea survey conducted in November last year found that 21% of Korean adults said they were currently experiencing hair loss symptoms.
That's a serious condition. You know, laughs aside, people with it can go through a lot of stress. Can we hear from those who are not as supportive, however?
Well, one strong voice that's being made at the top level in terms of the health ministry is the health minister herself, Chung Eun-kyung. Initially, she opposed expanding coverage for common hair loss, arguing that it does not threaten life or health, and that cosmetic concerns have traditionally fallen outside the scope of national health insurance benefits. In many countries, hair loss remains firmly categorized as a cosmetic issue. The Korean Medical Association urged the government to prioritize coverage for cancer and other serious illnesses, expressing concerns over characterizing hair loss as a matter of life and death for young people. Beginning in 2026, the national health insurance system is projected to run annual deficits exceeding 4 trillion won, or some $2.6 billion. So that's another issue that we need to thoroughly look at.
That's a lot of money. But that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us all the stories, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time now for Sports Roundup, your weekly look at all the action from the big wins and tough losses to the stories on and off the field. Joining us now on the line to help us do that is Yoo Ji-ho, the sports beat writer for Yonhap News. Ji-ho, great to have you here again on the show.
Yeah, happy to be here too.
We start our segment with, again, the World Cup. After a painful loss to Mexico last week, South Korea will play their final Group A match of the FIFA World Cup against South Africa this week with a knockout spot at stake. Ji-ho, could you give us a preview of this crucial matchup?
Yeah, crucial indeed. But Korea will control their own destiny as they will look to reach the round of 32. The kickoff will be 10 a.m. Thursday in Korean time out in Monterrey, Mexico. Korea in second place in the group after beating Czechia 2-1 but losing to Mexico 1-0. Mexico clinched the top spot and a place in the knockouts with that victory, leaving Korea in second place. Thanks to tie-breaking scenarios, Korea can progress to the knockouts with at least a draw against South Africa. And they will be regardless of the outcome of the match between Mexico and Czechia, which will take place the same time on Thursday morning here. Now, in addition to the top two teams from each of the 12 groups, the eight best third-place teams will also qualify for the knockouts this time. So Korea can still sneak into the knockouts as a third-ranked team from the group, even if they lose to South Africa, provided that Czechia also lose or have a draw against Mexico. However, a Korean loss and a Czechia victory on Thursday will eliminate Korea as the last-place team in this group. So obviously, you know, I know it's a cliche, but anything can happen. Usually does happen in football. Korea should not get into a position where they have to sweat out the other match taking place in Mexico City.
I think it's safe to assume that a high-stakes game awaits Team Korea. What will the team have to do against South Africa, though, to secure the ticket to the next round?
Yeah, so if you look at just the on-paper talent, there's really no excuse for Korea not to win this match. You know, they're way ahead of them in the rankings, number 25 to compared to number 60 for South Africa in the last official FIFA rankings before the tournament. I think Korea, they've got to be sharper in the attacking third. You know, they had the ball so much against Mexico, but could not convert their possession advantage into goals. South Africa, they've given up goals in early moments of both of their first two matches. Ninth minute against Mexico, they ended up losing the 2-0. And they gave up the goal in the sixth minute against Czechia. They, you know, the battle back ended up in a 1-1 draw in that one. So their defense can be shaky, especially in the early moments, and Korea must look to attack early. They have not yet scored in the first half of this tournament, of the any matches in this tournament yet. But you know, no need to wait around, kind of wait around for the game to come to them this time. And also, South Africa will be without two key midfielders. Teboho Mokoena received his second yellow card in two matches during the Czechia contest. He's the one that scored the penalty in that one, but he's ineligible against Korea. And another midfielder, Semba Zwane, he was sent off against Mexico. And after that, he was suspended by FIFA for three matches. So he's not available against Korea either. But Korea head coach Hong Myung-bo said his players should not be thinking about who will not be playing for the other team, because, you know, they might make them feel a little complacent. They might make them feel maybe a little bit arrogant. So they've just got to focus on what they have to do and not worry about the other team. And also South Africa, you know, they might be fired up with their backs against the wall. You know, they've got nothing to lose. You know, they're going to be without a couple of key players. The other guys will try to pick up their slack. So they could, you know, this could be a really dangerous team for Korea.
So Team Korea will be favored. But as Gio points out, anything can happen in football. So not the right time to get complacent. What can we expect, though, in the other Group A match on the last day between Mexico and Czechia?
Yeah, so Korean fans will obviously hope that they will not have to worry about that one. But just in case something funny happens, so Czechia must lose or set up for draw against home team Mexico in order for Korea to advance, whether they win, lose, or have a draw against South Africa. So this is a must-win scenario for Czechia. Obviously, they're going to do whatever it takes to try to beat Mexico. And that's going to be tough to do in Mexico City's iconic Azteca Stadium. And Mexico, they're already through to the knockouts. Most likely, maybe they will rotate and rest some of the regulars in preparation for the next phase. But perhaps, you know, they're going to obviously try to win on the home soil as well. So they cannot afford to lose on home soil, even if they've already booked their spot in the knockouts. So, you know, they're going to be out, I think, playing hard. But again, Korea cannot be, you know, relying on help from other teams. They just got to go out there and just take care of their own business in their own match.
So not the right time to get complacent nor tempt the fates. We now move on to baseball. In the KBO, the league leading, just want to savor that for a few seconds, the league leading LG Twins will have to have a big midweek series against the Samsung Lions coming up as they try to stay in first place. Gio, give us a preview of the next week in KBO action.
Yeah, so the Twins have been in first place since May 30th. You know, broke a tie with the Lions at the top at the time. They've since pulled away a little bit. Now, three-game lead over the KT Wiz in second place. The Lions, three and a half games back. So the Lions and the Twins, they're going to meet for three games beginning at Tuesday at Changsha Stadium. Both teams coming off really solid weeks. The Lions have been 3-2-0 against the Twins so far this season. So the Twins actually have been under 500 against their two closest rivals. I mentioned the KT Wiz also have a winning record against the Twins. But the Twins have been feasting against everybody else in the league. Now, after the Lions series, the Twins will visit the surging Lotte Giants down in Busan. The Giants were in last place on June 14th. But they've gone on a five-game winning streak, actually had a tie during that streak So they've kind of climbed out of the league cellar, right now sitting in eighth place, and trying to get back into sort of the thick of the race for the final playoff spot.
Mm. Playing in Busan is never easy, even when the Giants are struggling. The Twins, unlike in 2023 or 2025, when they won the Korean Series, they're not really on top of either batting or pitching. I mean, the Twins are an unimpressive fifth in runs scored so far this season. So the Twins have pulled off a rare feat last weekend when they scored four home runs in a single inning, in the first inning. I unfortunately was unable to watch that live. I tuned in a little later in the game and looked at the stats and was really wondering what in the world had happened. So, Gio, so going to the Twins game last weekend against the Bears, what happened in the first inning?
Yeah, so four solo home runs in the bottom of the first inning by the Twins en route to a 9-3 win over the Doosan Bears. And like you said, this is not a home run hitting team this year. They do have the guy who leads the league in home run, Austin Dean, but they're as a team, they're right in the middle of the pack in slugging home runs and runs scored, you know, you name it, they're right in the middle of it in the league rankings. But, you know, up against the lefty starter, Zach Logue, four right-handed batters, each hit a solo shot in that first inning in Sunday's game. Song Chan-yi leading off with the homer, Austin Dean hitting his league-leading 21st homer, and Park Dong-won and Moon Jung-bin going back-to-back. So they became the first team in KBO history to hit four homers in the first inning.
Mm.
And also the first team to hit four homers in an inning at Jamsil Stadium, which is the largest one in the league. So that's really the toughest park to hit a home run in, and they did it at their home park. You know, this is the final year at Jamsil before the stadium gets demolished, and they're going to put up a new dome there in the same spot. So the Twins, they gave their fans some memorable moments with these four dingers in one inning.
So rooting for the Twins from here, yours truly. But we go to our final sport of the segment, golf, where Tom Kim celebrated his 24th birthday by finishing third at the U.S. Open in New York. It was an encouraging performance for Kim, I hear, in the midst of a disappointing season.
Yeah, so Tom Kim finished alone in third place at one on the par 279, three shots behind the champion, Wyndham Clark. You know, Clark nearly collapsed after beginning the final round with a six-shot lead over Kim and three other players. But Kim could not quite take advantage, ran out of holes at the end, but there's still really good performance by him. You know, he turned 24 on this day, Father's Day in the U.S. You know, he's not a father yet, but, you know, got to celebrate his birthday. His third career top 10 at a major, his second top 10 of the year in 15 starts. You know, here's a guy, not that long ago, he was like the next big thing in men's golf. You know, had three wins by the end of 2023, reached as high as number 11 in the world rankings, but he's completely fallen off the radar since. He actually was 141st in the world rankings before this. He jumped to 64th after the U.S. Open. So, you know, maybe sign of better things to come for Tom going forward. Again, he's only 24 years old. Hopefully it's going to be the turning point for the guy. You know, there's so much hype around him just a couple of years ago. He's been really struggling, but potentially this could be the turning point for him.
A shout out to Tom Kim and congratulations on the performance in New York. I'm sure he needed that. But that's all for this week's Sports Roundup. That was UGO, the sports writer for Yonhap News. Thank you, Gio.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back tomorrow. It was a blast serving as your host today. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident. than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.
KBS World Radio.